Hey everybody, it's the Retro Computing Roundtable, Show 9. This is David Grealish, and I'm hosting today. I'm in Johns Creek, Georgia, and I also host a Classic Computing video podcast, and I read Stan Veit's History of the Personal Computer audiobook podcast. The Retro Computing Roundtable is your show for enthusiasts of computer history and collectors by enthusiasts of computer history and collectors.
And I'm Carrington Vanston up here in Toronto, Canada, and I'm host of 1 Megahertz, which is an Apple II podcast.
And I'm Earl Evans from Portland, Oregon. I'm the host of the RetroBits podcast.
Hey, guys.
How you doing, David?
Hello.
I am doing really good. So this is our first, it's show 9, but it's kind of show 1 of the new Retro Computing Roundtable. So I'm hosting duties, but we're going to take turns because myself and Carrington and Earl, we're all co-hosts, I guess is a good title, permanent panelists. So the format has changed of the show, and I think it's a good thing to move forward. We didn't discuss this before the show, but I guess it's still open that we could sometimes have guests on. I guess we'll just discuss
sure.
it on air if you want.
Yeah, that works for me.
If okay. anybody randomly Skypes me during the show, I'll just put them on.
Yeah, add them in. That would be kind of fun, actually. Well, anything new with you guys? I guess I'll start off, and then I'll... this morning, I was telling you guys earlier, I ran off. Somebody donated a computer to the cause to me. It's a Commodore 128, which I had one, but I had nothing else with it. So this is what's really nice about this system is the gentleman had actually bought it for his family, brand new, so original owner, and came with I think it's a 1902. Does that sound right? Display.
It does. Yep.
And the 1571 disk drive, 1200 baud modem, Panasonic 24-pin printer, and a bunch of software. So it's really nice to
wow, nice.
Have
that's
this
a totally
complete
system.
Yeah, and from the original owner, all inclusive. So I like that. I have a Apple IIgs. That's the same sort of thing. The family.
No,
bought
no,
it.
It's not the same. It's better.
Well, they know.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was they had bought it originally in '87, and then I acquired the whole system from them, software and everything. Notes for the games and that kind of stuff.
It's nice. It's great when a retro system can go to a new home that will appreciate it and actually maybe use the thing a bit.
Indeed. Is it the flat kind of all in one keyboard model?
Yeah. Yeah, it's not is it the 128D? It's not that one.
Uh-huh.
Which is cool, though. I'd like to have one of those. I think those people probably still sell those, and they garner some more cash.
The 128D and the DCR in America does actually go for a decent price.
Mm-hmm.
Sell it on eBay. I've got one of those. I love it. Well, I have one of the other ones, too. But, the 128, that's my favorite 8-bit. Computer, I think, ever, because it's like three
really?
Different computers in one. I mean, it's
a
128. It's got a complete Commodore 64 guts in there, so it's about as close to 100% compatible with a 64 as you can get without being a 64. And it can also run CPM.
Yeah, Commodore was pretty good at that, putting out systems. They had a few different models over the years that had multiple computer guts inside them.
Yeah. Yeah, so this one... Yep, I hope you have a lot of fun with that, David.
Did it have? I'm looking it up right now. Did it have? Does it have a Z80 in it? Is that how it runs the? Yeah, it does.
That's correct.
Yeah, I have that for CPM.
Okay, yep. So it has two processors. So the MOS 8502 handles the Commodore 64 side of things, plus the 128. I think you have to step down the speed, right? Or you have the choice of doing so when you're running Commodore 64.
It does actually. With the 128, you can run it at 2 megahertz. And when you're in 64 mode, it runs at 1 megahertz.
There's nothing wrong with 1 megahertz.
Yeah, but 2 megahertz is faster.
Well, anything reasonably new with either of you guys? I'm going to hog this part of the show. Carrington, what's up?
I think I mentioned maybe it was in the last show. It was right around that time that I picked up a sealed copy of a vintage Infocom game, Suspended. It did arrive, and it's everything I'd hoped to be. So I have
the mask
version of that,
yeah.
Still in shrink wrap. I'm very excited about it.
Oh, see, you got to post some pictures of that.
Well, I'll be posting
a lot
of photos. I'll be doing a live unshrink wrapping for 1 megahertz, just so I can hear the other collectors scream. So I'm looking forward to playing it. So yeah, there'll be lots of photos of the unboxing.
You know, this makes me think of something, because we were talking about your other podcast, Double Take.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an interesting dynamic that I always liked about 1 MHz, and you have this dynamic on Double Take, is that you have the sounds of opening stuff.
Right.
Because
I guess that's my theme, isn't it? I like to hold things up to the microphone and rip them open.
There's just something.
Oh, I hadn't really thought of that.
There's just something really, I don't know, interesting about that. You're opening the envelopes, and then you're opening the shrink wrap, and you're pulling stuff out of the box. It's just.
I think it comes from the fact, though, from basically the second episode of my 1 MHz on. I have considered switching it to a video podcast because it's very difficult to describe to people. I mean, I mostly do game reviews on 1 MHz, and I'm having to describe, here's what the box looks like, here's what the graphics are like, and a lot of times it would be easier just to hold it up and to show the game being played and that sort of stuff. So I've continually thought about switching that to a video podcast. So I guess that's why I'm sort of trying to get as close as I can to that in audio, and so you get the sounds of the shrink wrap being opened and sounds of the books being shuffled.
That'd be cool, but I really like, I think the audio has always worked very well for you though. So
yeah. And I'm a big fan of audio podcasts and audio books. I listen to a lot of each of them because I have a very long commute to work.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the kind of thing that I'm trying to cater to the same sort of audience that I would be and make the kind of podcast that I would consume. I don't really watch a lot of video podcasts, because you have to dedicate yourself to doing just that. Whereas audio podcasts and audiobooks can be run in the background. You can enjoy them while you're doing something else.
Yeah, exactly. I like to go for walks, mm-hmm. up the hill around my house. And when I'm doing that, you know, it's good for exercise, and it's nice when I have some podcasts I can listen to. And I couldn't do that with a video podcast, obviously. So
right. I always tend my video ones kind of pile up because I have to make special time for them versus the stuff I can listen to on the commute.
Right. And Earl, what's new with you?
Gosh, what's going on in my end? I have not had a lot of time lately, unfortunately, and it's killing me to work with my retro computing hobby, because the rest of life has just exploded. At work is in a busy time right now, and I'm also trying to learn iOS programming. There's a great class that I'm taking for free through iTunes University from Stanford.
I did the same thing.
Oh, you went through that? Yeah,
I did. Absolutely. I'm working on my first iOS software program right now, and I went through the Stanford stuff first.
It's really a nice resource, and I'm amazed that they make it available for free, including the lecture notes and the homeworks. And obviously, you don't get credit for taking the course, but you learn all the stuff, and the quality is very high. So working through that, trying to squeeze in as much Japanese learning as I can before my tutor goes back to Japan here in a couple months, which is killing me. Because it's been very effective doing the one-on-one tutoring thing for my language learning. And it's just – so tons of stuff going on. But unfortunately, kind of squeezing out the retro computing hobby a little bit. So I got to elbow that back in somehow.
And those darn kids.
Yeah, and
they,
family.
They take a lot of time.
Family. Well, I'll talk about that when we get to the end. But that is one area that actually ironically has kept me – in the retro computing stuff a little bit. It was my daughter and I working through basic programming on the Atari. But like I say, I'll get to that later. But yeah.
And you did do a Retro Bits, which was great. We interviewed Evan Koblitz.
So I did.
That was good.
Got a Retro Bits podcast out with Evan. Evan's great on the air and talked about the Vintage Computer Festival, which I think we'll mention when we get to our topics. But
it was a good interview.
Well, yeah, thanks. I always like chatting with Evan, and I thought that was good to get it out ahead of time so that, people can start to build up some enthusiasm for that event, because it sounds like it's going to be great.
Yep.
All right, so we'll move on to our news and items of interest segment. And the first thing we have up here is I had did this before and kind of went back and forth, so I started up again where I'm actually mentioning, and so I'll put it in the show notes too, about, this was tweeted by someone, and that's how I found out about it. And I think the people that I'm following, I'm pretty selective about it. They're good people to follow that you get good news items from. So this was tweeted by @C_64, and he said, in case you forgot how long it took to load a game, quote-unquote, back then, here's a reminder. So it's just a YouTube video. Did you guys have a chance to look at that? It's like 7 minutes long,
And it's loading from tape, which slows it down quite a bit.
Yeah, that's it, really. It's just, but exactly, if you forgot how long it took or takes, it's just insane. But
there's a lot of that stuff on YouTube. There's an interesting sort of subgenre of retro computing, which is the whole back in my day, we had to walk uphill both ways to school, that sort of thinking. And there's a lot of that stuff. And some of it's really entertaining about how long it would take somebody to load or sort of playing up the limitations of older computers. But I find the same thing happens to me now with modern things, just at a different scale. If something isn't instantaneous, I find that it feels like it's taking forever. I can't believe how long this email's taking. It's over a second. it's crazy how our standards just change with technology over time.
Firefox taking 20 seconds to load. What's wrong with it?
You know, that's kind of funny, is that one of my favorite games, recent games, has been Portal.
Yeah, great game.
Love that game. But, you know, first you got to load up Steam, and then you got to load up Portal, and, you know, it's sitting there and it's just tick, 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 tick. And, you know, you're right. I mean, it doesn't really take that long. I mean, it's nothing like loading up Jumpman on the Commodore 64 through incredibly slow 15, you know, the famously slow 1541 drives on the Commodore. But still, I click load and I'm like, come on, man, let's get with it. I want this right now.
Yeah. There's some interesting comments in here. And one thing that was somebody said, I don't know if it's an introduction, but they mentioned what was neat about the Commodore 64. And I don't believe the Apple II could do this, Carrington, but let us know.
Apple II could do everything.
You know, this show is going to really have an interesting dynamic, too, because Earl, I know you're more of a Commodore guy. Carrington, you're definitely more of an Apple guy. I'm definitely more leaning to Mac as my all-time favorite, but I'm also a Commodore guy. So it's kind of... But anyway, where the Commodore 64, especially in something like this, it would take a real long time to load, but it could actually play little tunes in between time and throw up graphics on the screen while it was loading.
At least it was a bit entertaining.
Yeah.
Things were happening. Yeah.
So could the Apple II do that, Carrington?
Apple II could do everything. It depends on the program. Yeah.
According to the Apple II guys, like at the center of the internet, you know, the core.
The internet is run on Apple II. Crazy how few people know that. It's actually just a single original 2 Plus that is at the heart of all internet traffic goes through that.
It's in Waz's garage, too.
Totally. He hand-built it, and it can handle anything. But yes, the Apple II could have loading screens. It's really more about the nature of programming, loading bits in a chunk. So really you're loading a small program that's loading the rest of it. And that small program, its task is to show stuff on the screen and to dump into memory the rest of the real program that you want to run. So a lot of Apple II games would do that. It's essentially the same thing that a lot of Flash programs on the internet do now, where it's showing you stuff, but really it's just loading stuff in the background and it's playing a little separate animation at the same time.
Well, the next item we're going to talk about, and actually, there's two things by this particular gentleman here, so we'll talk about it. But this was tweeted by Ives, Bolognini?
That's exactly how it's pronounced.
So it's, and it's, this is in the show notes, but it's at, you know, Ives Bolo. Why? Anyway, you can go to the show notes. But real cool guy. I think he's in, just go check him out. But he tweets a lot of good stuff. So basically, it's a link to a Technologizer article written by, help me here, guys, Benji, is it, or just Benj?
I think it's Benj.
Benj Edwards?
Benj as well, yeah.
And so he's put together one of these pictorials, and then one of the other items of interest here is another pictorial by him, and I think it's in PC World.
And yeah. Benj has written some amazing stuff, by the way.
Yeah, he has, and he's come up on the show, it turns out, a few times, because I've gone to his site, his blog, a number of times. So, yeah, he writes a lot of great stuff. So, basically, it's a pictorial. This one's called 15 Amazing Computing Rarities of the 1990s. So, worth looking at. One of the first ones is Sega Terra Drive, which I had never heard of. So, you guys let me know if you have any comments on any of this stuff.
Well, I look through this and I did find it extremely interesting. I'd recommend people take a look through here. It just started to give me back that feeling of the 90s. You know, in the 80s, you kind of had this Cambrian explosion of personal computer models and technologies and stuff like that. And the 90s was kind of like the die-off. I mean, if you walk through here, you see several companies and several technologies that didn't quite make it through the ultimate shakeout in the computing industry.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing that kind of caught my eyes as I was going through. I was like, oh, yeah, I remember them. They're gone now.
Right.
I think you had, obviously by 19, like this first item here, the Sega Teradrive, 1991. The 90s, 1990. Pretty much you had, obviously you had DOS dominating PCs. Okay. And then you had Macintosh as a fairly far second. And then you had Amiga, which kind of was, you guys correct me if I'm wrong, but I would say they're maybe third. But maybe they're in there, they're mixed in with Atari, and then of course some of your 8-bit users are still around, Apple IIgs and Apple IIs and so on.
Yeah, by the 90s, Atari really had been pretty much relegated to just music fans and stuff. It was running under the same chips, if I recall. I was never an Atari guy, but it was the Motorola 68K stuff.
Mm-hmm. It was.
I think it was very popular
520
with,
ST and 1040 ST. And
right. The Atari stuff was, their Motorola stuff was roughly on par with the Commodore, same chipset kind of thing. And is kind of interesting war, but you're right, David. They were battling for a distant position. They were not mainstream.
The third item here is a B box, which if you guys are familiar with that from B, mm-hmm. that was a company started by Jean-Louis Gassi, who was, I believe, he's like vice president or some higher up guy of European operations of Apple.
And, and was in the running to be mm-hmm. the basis of the Apple OS.
Right.
When Apple instead bought Next and brought Steve Jobs back, a lot of people second-guessed that decision at the time, but clearly it worked out to be the right thing.
Yeah.
But at the time, I remember playing with a VBox, and it was a really interesting operating system with some mm-hmm. really cool advantages, especially in terms of threading and multitasking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. I know that a couple of these came up for auction recently, I think in the last year or so, because James and John had it on their on the Retro Maccast. They covered it in one of their auctions. So, yeah, definitely that's rare and interesting. Then they have the Apple network server, which is, it's interesting. James,
so I think if I'm not looking at the moment, but I think in the article we're talking about, it says that the Apple network server was the only official Apple computer designed to not run an Apple operating system. Is that true?
James and John have talked about this one before, and I think James has one.
I know that it ran AIX, or AUX rather, but I swear there was another one.
As far as I know, this is the only one. In other words, this is not a Macintosh.
I think people should write in and tell us.
So this is an audience thing. Yeah, but this would be the only this would be the only exception of an Apple computer after Apple IIs, IIIs, Lisas, non-Macs It was not a Macintosh,
So I don't know. I really think there was another server option later that ran something else that wasn't designed to run an Apple operating system. I really think there was, but I can't think of what it is. It occurred to me when I read this article. I thought, I'll come up with it later, but I still haven't come up with it. But I think that's a bit of incorrect trivia.
Okay.
My gut is telling me that there's something else. And I do know at the Apple stores, for a while, they ran a different operating system on the little handhelds, but they weren't made by Apple, so they wouldn't count. And I think Apple's iTunes servers themselves don't run the Apple operating system, but I don't think they're Macs, so those wouldn't count either. But I really think there's another one somewhere that's something obscure, and I'm just not able to think of it at the moment.
So there's 17 items in here. So do you guys have one you want to talk about? I won't go through all of them. The Commodore CD TV looks pretty interesting. It's all black, kind of sleek looking.
I think it had the 20th anniversary Mac on there as well, which is a neat sort of computer. The one I found most interesting is something we'll probably talk about more if we're going to talk about that article about Atari history.
Mm-hmm.
It has that really tiny, the ST book. Which I found a very interesting crazily failed project by Atari. but a very interesting short-lived portable computer.
Let's two other ones I noticed here is like the Macintosh TV, which was a black all-in-one based on like the LC 520, 550, 575, mm-hmm. all that. And essentially all it was one of those that was black with a TV tuner card in it.
And a TV tuner card that you could get separately and stick in them. It really just, yeah. The only thing that separated this was it was the black version.
It was cool for 1993, but did you know that when you watched TV on it, you could not also use a computer? It didn't like put it in a window. It became a TV.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I had video in on a Power Mac, 7200s and 7600s. And those ones were later computers, and you could run it in Windows and stuff. I for a while, managed the world's largest cyber cafe. So there's a little bit of trivia about me.
You did?
Here in Toronto. It's called the Electric Bean, and a lot of the systems were Macs. And at the time, they were 7600s. And we used those to power... use video in, and so you sit at the keyboard, and if you wanted, you could play video games. Like you could sit at a computer that also had like a Nintendo hooked up to it, or I don't remember what the systems were at the time, but we'll say Nintendo, yeah. And like an early or a PlayStation, but it was a PlayStation 1, and you could switch over to the PlayStation, and that was just being pumped in through the video in on the Mac, and it would just switch over to that system.
So we'll move into the other. What is that? One last thing. The last picture is like a junkyard of something, but 15 of 17. I always thought this was a cool machine, the HP OmniBook 300 from 93, where you push a little button and that little mouse popped out of the side.
Out of the side, yeah.
That was pretty clever. I like that.
And, you know, the last one that I would mention on here, I didn't even know there was ever a laptop based on the Alpha CPU.
Yeah,
That was news to me as well.
And I'll tell you, we had an Alpha, I think this was 95, the company I was working at the time was Mentor Graphics, and we were rolling out Windows NT as our network operating system, and they'd given us an Alpha for evaluation, and that thing was fast. I mean, I'm really kind of disappointed that chip technology didn't have the opportunity, I guess, you know, in the competitive landscape to move forward, because that was great. And I think this machine, if I can dig up enough on this Tadpole machine, I might even do a podcast of Retrobits on this one, because this is just fascinating to me that there, of course, the price tag at $14,000, it doesn't surprise me that it didn't do so well, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I worked at a company in like late 90s, 98 starting, and I remember we had a number of those machines running NT 3.51, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Did Microsoft do anything to kind of undermine that? Well, could that have been part of it? Or
I don't really know the history on that. It'd be interesting to find out. Because you probably saw they performed really well. It was very interesting technology. So I could set that box next to an Intel box running NT with, you know, roughly similar specs or whatever, and the Alpha would just blow it away, just leave it in the dust.
So let's move on to the other pictorial, The History of Atari Computers, also by Benj Edwards, this time for PC World. And so these are fun. You know, it makes me kind of want to maybe – I was just thinking of this, that maybe because it's hard to get blog articles going, maybe I'll do some of these pictorials. Because, you know, there's not that much writing involved, and just throw some pictures up there. Because you got to think about copyright.
Sure, I guess where you get the pictures from. I found it was
Wikipedia.
Interesting to look through it. I was never really much of an Atari guy. But I always loved the Atari 800's industrial design. Mm-hmm. It's one of my favorite old computers. I like the look of it so much.
Yeah.
So I never really used one that much. But I really disliked Atari's industrial design by the time it got into the 90s. Like I never liked those parallelogram buttons that used for the function keys. I thought they were just so indicative of 80s or 90s style over usability, like way to make a button more difficult to get your finger on. And they did that all the way through, like all their computers in the 90s. That's how you could tell it was an Atari. It had those stupid leaning buttons.
The Atari 800, and I don't have one of these, and I was never a big Atari person either in computers, but you know what it strikes me as is it if you were to like cover the top part above the keyboard, it looks almost just like a Commodore 64, and then looking at the case, it looks like an Apple II, kind of.
It does have a little bit of, I mean, that kind of leaning, what would you say, the front part, mm-hmm. you know, but the rest of it being kind of flat back across. It does have a little bit of case resemblance.
Of course, it came out before the Apple II, didn't it?
I'm sorry,
Commodore 64, so. I mean.
Yeah, that definitely. But yeah.
The same sort of chunky buttons from that period, and I was a big fan of that sort of keyboard.
This is the first computer I had at home, actually, because we sold them in the retail store I was working at, and they would give us one of the computer models that they had in the store to take home just for educational purposes, which I thought was cool. So, soft spot in my heart for that old Atari 800 also, Carrington. Mm.
Much more than the 400, because I was never a fan of the bubble keyboards. But the 800 is such nice industrial design. I think it's just a beautiful piece of technology.
The 1200 XL, that's a sharp-looking box, I think. So just going
all
through
about
here.
Those leaning buttons, though.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I see
what you're saying.
In that article, though, it talked about two Atari computers that I always found very interesting. One was the Stacy portable.
Mm-hmm.
Which was a really nice looking portable and it was only $2,000, which, you know, this is out at the same time as like the Apple portable and stuff. And it's competing against computers that were two and three times the retail price. And I think what killed the Stacy was, though, it's notorious for having a 15 minute battery life at most. And it took big C cell batteries. So
Good
you
Lord.
Have to buy new ones every time, and you That's, stick them in, and it would run for at most 15 minutes. So completely ridiculous. As
yeah.
a portable.
That's 15, picture 15, and 1989, between 6,500. Oh, no, that's the, oh, $2,000. Yeah, compared to the Macintosh portable for $7,000. Yeah, that's ridiculous.
But also think of it at the time, like how long it would take to load something. We were talking earlier in this episode about sitting for, you know, there's a 7-minute YouTube video to show the loading of one game. Imagine if your computer is only going to run for 15 minutes.
Yeah.
So it's a completely unusable thing. But I remember at the time having a discussion with somebody saying Atari is just completely throwing away a market here, because the Stacy was one of the first computers that I used that was a portable that would automatically switch to battery power if you yanked out the cord, in the same way that the early Apple PowerBooks was, like the PowerBook 100,
right.
You could swap the battery live and stuff, very cool. But with the Stacy, it was the time we were talking about how this was one of the first computers, well, that I had heard of, that if you're running it on AC power and you just yank out the power cable, it just keeps running. It just switches on. It's sort of always running on battery if you have batteries in it. So I remember at the time saying, well, why don't they just promote it instead of being a portable computer? It's a relocatable computer. So you buy one computer that you have at work, but you can also have it at home. And so you're saving money by doing that. And it's got this great built-in UPS. And don't promote it as 15 minutes of portable usability, which is useless. Promote it as 15 minutes of time to save your data in case the power goes out.
Right,
that would
right.
be a great feature.
And, interesting.
And instead, yeah. So I thought this is all Atari once again screwing up the marketing, because if they marketed it that way, everybody would want to buy it for business. So I really remember that computer, having long discussions in a cafe about this computer that I had only read about in an article.
I wonder if this machine suffers from the same problem the Macintosh Portable has, where because I think it does the same thing. But the problem with it is, if you have a Macintosh Portable and the battery is completely bad, it won't work. It won't power up, because so in other words, you can't pull the battery out and plug it in and use it, because it has to go through the battery, a working battery, to function.
Yeah, and the Stacy actually just used like C cell batteries, so I don't know if it would have been worked as a UPS thing anyway, because you'd have to be always putting new C cells. I don't know. The whole computer was a bit of a mess. So
now the one just before it, 14. Whoops. Nope. I'm sorry. 13 is the Atari Portfolio, and I have one of these, and a really cool little palm top computer that actually ran MS-DOS.
I would love to have one of those. And I remember seeing one like way back in the day. Those are great.
Yeah, they're nice, and mine still works. And let's look it up. Oh, you know, this is something I don't think I said in our introduction. Of course, we've talked about it, but that's a big difference we're doing with the new show too, is that we're doing, it's a live format. I didn't cover that, did I?
So we didn't talk about that.
Yeah. So everybody, we hit record, we start talking. It may or may not be as perfect as it ought to be, and then boom, it gets uploaded today. instead of a week from
like
now.
And it's just like you're sitting in the living room right next to us.
Yeah, kind of like
but
a
not
dig-
able to talk.
Faux pas and all.
And with time, we'll all start drinking beer, and we can do our own dignation sort of.
Start.
No, Carrington's well into it now.
Hey, there's a few of them on eBay, Earl. Here's one: buy it now for $75 or best offer. I'll get off to. Oh, it's in Romania. It's only $15 shipping. Mint wow. condition, minor scratches.
Doesn't actually exist.
How is it in mint condition if it has minor scratches?
Seems like a discrepancy.
But anyway, you know, so you can pick these guys up. All right, so we'll move forward. What anything else? There's some interesting big old Atari PC compatibles, which I don't believe I have ever seen one in real life. So I don't know who bought those. The Mega STE, that's pretty cool. Of course,
the Mega, yeah.
Well, and then near the end is the Atari ST book, which is pretty slick looking.
Oh, but the ST book, what I find interesting about that one is this, I think I touched on it earlier, but we're live, so I can't remember. And,
yeah.
It was like a really nice looking, very slim, it's like less than 5 pounds as a portable. And
very nice
looking. It had no floppy disk. One of the reasons why it was so small is and this is 8 or 9 years before the iMac came out and was such a big deal that it had no floppy. But Atari did this with the ST book. And it was... The problem with the ST book was, once again, Atari messing up the industrial design. Mm-hmm. It was a crazily cheap, really poorly made and flimsy plastic case
that would
basically fall apart if you touched it. Like, it was a portable that you couldn't move. You could barely touch. So I think they only made something like 1,000 of them. So it's a very, very rare item.
Yeah, I was reading that.
Nice looking, but it really didn't come out at all. It was more made, I think, as a proof of concept, and they proved that you can't use that kind of plastic on a computer, and it would just completely fall apart. So it's near impossible to find one in decent shape.
I've only heard of them and seen pictures. I don't think I've ever, you know, seen one on eBay or anyone they own one or anything like that.
It may not actually even have existed. Maybe they just made articles about it and you know, fake photographs or something. I've never seen one in real life.
The next item is really just something to mention that we came across recently. It's called The Day in Tech History. So it's a daily little podcast. So there's a link in the show notes to, I guess it's like a player. But have you guys ever seen this before?
No, I hadn't heard of it before.
So daily rundown of historical facts and technology.
I mean, really, it plays if, I guess, the neat 5 or 6 things that happen on this day.
Mm-hmm. Like today's was about the 1964, the standards Eastern automatic computers retired after 15 years. So I wonder if does it mention where they're pulling their the data from. But for instance, yesterday, the Mosaic web browser was released in 1993. Mm-hmm. April 21st was MITS versus Bill Gates, Microsoft on 8080 Basic.
So and it does list a number of things. I listened to the current one, and he read off a number of things that happened this day in history. Another one was the release for Macintosh of Internet Explorer 2.0 came out for the Mac and needed System 7.01. Mm-hmm. So that was something else mentioned that happened on this day. I think it's the kind of podcast, so I guess you listen to it for 1 year, and then you're done. I guess they would just start repeating.
Yeah. There was a great podcast I used to listen to called, and I believe it was called, and it's still around, This Day in Apple History, I think. And I think I listened to it for a couple of years, but yeah, it repeated, and I heard them all over 2 years, so I stopped listening to it.
Well, you just got to wait for a leap year so you get that one new episode.
Right. All right, our next item, and so maybe this will engage us quite a bit. It's been in the news, is a new book by Paul Allen called Idea Man. And either of you guys going to buy this or going to read or are reading this by any chance?
I'm going to get this book and read it. You know, of course, you know, when reporters are on about these things, they go for the sensationalist bits, right? So the excerpt that was posted online about the book was Paul Allen talking about the early history with Bill Gates and some of the things that went on and, you know, the friction and that kind of thing. So, but I'm imagining, based on the link that you sent out, David, before the show, that the book is obviously way broader than that. And yeah, of all of the people at Microsoft, you know, the famous founders, I think I probably know the least about Paul Allen. So it's going to be really interesting to read his biographical perspective.
Right. I agree. He left Microsoft in, I believe, 1982. I'm looking for it in here off the top of my head. So he was very much out of the limelight, you know, of the industry for a long time. You know, and obviously Bill Gates dominated Microsoft and, you know, was sort of like Steve Jobs with Apple.
Right. And I don't get the impression that he particularly likes the limelight either.
Right,
I think
yeah.
that over the course of his life, he's kind of tried to avoid it. I mean, even with, you know, not making conspicuous public appearances, to my knowledge, with things like the Trailblazers here in Portland that he owns.
All and, right.
Yeah, you know, that kind of thing. So
that's right. He owns
I wonder
a team.
If the book will include the stuff about how he's currently now suing everybody that's ever existed. Because, I mean, really, I
he talks about that in an interview. He was interviewed, and I can't – I don't think it was 60 Minutes. Maybe it was Good Morning America or something, but he was asked about that. And he so he spoke to that a little bit recently because he's been – you know, he's been on some appearances and stuff talking about the book. I bought the book. In fact, this book is the first Kindle book I've ever bought for my, month and a half old iPad. So I haven't started reading it yet. But, you know, I heard all about it, and I saw and I heard a lot of negative stuff. And I'll just read this first little blurb here from this particular article. Despite 60 Minutes, Leslie Stahl calling Island resident Paul Allen a bitter billionaire and saying his book draws a dark portrait of his co-founder, Bill Gates, Idea Man reads like the reminiscence of a positive, forward-thinking computer nerd whose passion for engineering and invention led him to develop, with his Lakeside School classmate Bill Gates, what is widely considered the most famous computer operating system in the world. And I think if you go to Amazon and you read the book reviews, there should be a lot more even by now. I think you'll start seeing a fuller picture of what a lot of regular people think of the book, or maybe people that really read it. That it's not just
and
a total.
It's probably on Amazon because Amazon's one of the only two companies he's currently not suing. Amazon and Microsoft.
But in other words, it doesn't see. In reality, it's not him bashing Bill Gates, but he does have some, what do I want to say? Not destructive. He has some things to say about Bill Gates was a difficult guy at times to work with, and but you know, it's interesting if you think of the parallel between Apple Computer and Microsoft, with sort of Steve Jobs and Bill Gates being the alpha males. Is that a right term? And then Steve Wozniak and Paul Allen, they kind of went on to go live lives in a way, mm-hmm. instead of their entire life was consumed by this company and achievements. And because, you know, I admire both men a great deal, probably Steve mm-hmm. Jobs more. And, you know, but I don't know if I want to spend my whole life just doing that.
I've always thought I'd want to get in, make a fortune, and get out, and then get on to
live
the real stuff in life. Exactly. But, you know, I've been told that if you're of that mentality, then you're probably not going to be the person who's going to actually make the fortune in the first place. So I don't know. I guess time will tell. Because after I make my fortune, you know, I'll definitely let you guys know how it goes. But
we'll buy your book.
yeah, would you please? Because
yeah,
and I promise not to sue you.
Well, slam
no,
it.
No, I've you're no Paul Allen.
In a recent book, Earl Evans has damning things to say about Carrington Vanson and David Grealish on their once partnership.
But it's interesting, Guy. What you say is fascinating, David. It's kind of funny that there is that parallel, too. You know, Gates and Allen, mm-hmm. Jobs and Wozniak. It's an interesting parallel.
So who wants to speak about the Kansas Fest upcoming?
I do.
Okay.
<Les Brown. laughs>
And you're definitely going, right?
I am going, yeah. I'm really excited about it. I haven't actually signed up yet, but I do intend to. I'm very, very excited about going back. It'll be my second time hitting Kansas Fest, so I'm really, really keen on it. I've booked off the time and everything. So, but in particular, I want to mention that they've just announced there'll be a hands-on session with Vince Briel. He's the fellow who's sort of famous for making a lot of kits and kit versions of vintage computers. He has an Apple I replica and an Altair replica. And he'll be running a session at Kansas Fest this year that you can sign up for, where you would build your own version of his the A2 MP3 card, which is a card that you can place in a vintage Apple II and has a USB port, and you can plug in a USB thumb drive full of MP3s, and they use the Apple II to play the MP3. So it's an MP3 decoder for the Apple II, which is itself kind of cool and sort of a neat thing. But it's, I think, really interesting that you can go to the show and build your own. So you just basically bring your own soldering iron, and he'll walk you through it. And I think he's previously run sessions like this at Kansas Fest, but not at one where I was there. So I'm very keen to take part and build my own card while I'm there.
I know he had one because I went to the last Vintage Computer Festival East, which was in 2009, and I think in November or whatever, because or March, I don't know. They had to move the date, so that's why this current one is like a year and a half later. But he had one of these running there, which was pretty neat. And then he had the replica ones, and he hadn't completed the Altair Micro, that's what it is. But Vince Briel recently moved to California, and I believe he lived in somewhere more Midwest or Middle America, East Coast. I can't remember offhand. But he won't be going to the VCF East anytime soon, as far as I know. You know, across the whole country.
Right.
Yeah, so speaking of Kansas Fest, too, it is from Tuesday, July 19th to Sunday, July 24th. Are you going to be there that whole time?
Yeah, I'll come in on the Tuesday and leave on the Sunday. Normally, or at least from what I remember from the one time I went, the Tuesday night is a little more informal. Everybody arrives at some point on the Tuesdays, and there's usually an outing to just go to a restaurant and stuff. And it's the Wednesday through Saturday are the real days of the show. And Sunday is fairly informal, Sunday morning as well. But my intention is to be there for the whole show.
Hey, Carrington. So I've always wanted to – hey, how you doing? I've always wanted to go to one of those. Won't be able to make this year's. I'm wondering
– do it.
Could we get a little on-scene reporting from you?
Yeah, that's what I intended to do. I thought I'd do a little RCR reporting from there, do an interview or do some sort of something live from the show to give people a feel for what it's like to be at Kansas Fest. So yeah, I will definitely record something while I'm there.
That would be awesome.
And I will bring my little David and Earl sock puppet. Like the three of us are there.
I was going to send you the cardboard cutout.
Excellent.
Let's see. I want to mention, so again, you know, Earl, you being more of a Commodore person, you know about the, what is it called? It's in Chicago, the Emergency Commodore Convention. It's like the ECCC. Do you remember that? And then they also, last year, they held the Vintage Computer Festival Midwest. They did it jointly. And earlier this year, I had emailed both parties asking, you know, have you announced a date? Are you going to do it? And the guy, Jason, I think it's Jason Compton, there's two Jasons, but he said that they're definitely doing it, and but he's waiting to make, you know, arrangements before he announced a date. And so I haven't heard back from him, so I emailed him earlier this week, and I still haven't heard. So it's getting to be late April, I wonder if they're going to actually be able to do it, because that's in, like, July, I think, too, or maybe August or something. But I don't know, have you ever considered going to that?
I've wanted to go to a bunch of the different shows. It's all just been a matter of time and money. But
it needs to be a show up where you are. But you're a member of two Commodore user groups. You kind of have your own shows.
We do have local in-town activities here with both of those Commodore groups. So yeah. I suppose that does take a little bit of the edge off, but still would love to make it to one of these formal events sometime.
Well, so the last other event, of course, is, again, mentioned the Vintage Computer Festival East. And so, Earl, you just spoke to, you know, Evan in great detail. So that's Saturday and Sunday, May 14th and 15th. So that's, what, 3 weeks away? Today's Saturday, April 23rd. So
coming right up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Can you highlight anything more about that?
Well, as Evan pointed out, you kind of think of it like a vintage car show, except in this particular case, imagine a vintage car show where you could get in and drive the cars around. this show tends to focus on hands-on, tends to focus on active participation. They're going to have a show floor where people will be exhibiting various vintage computer things and also some kind of breakout sessions. And there will be a couple of different really hands-on activities there too, like working with old ASR 33 teletypes, which sounded fascinating, and building your own logic circuit out of transistors and diodes and resistors and that kind of thing. I mean, you're getting right down to the ones and zeros with that particular breakout session. So that sounded cool. And one of the most interesting things was the restoration effort beginning there in public view of the IBM 1130 mainframe that the March Mid-Atlantic retro computing hobbyists just recently acquired. So it just sounds like a fantastic show. I mean, if I was in the area, wild horses couldn't keep me away. So I think people should look into it. And it is coming right up, though. So,
and it was a definite for me to go, but I canceled. I had to. I could have maybe pulled it off, but I just started a new job this week, so I didn't really want to immediately put in, because I'd have to take 2 days off, a Friday and a Monday, because I was gonna drive. So I decided to put it off this year. And Carrington, I know you're considering going still. Strongly considering.
Yeah, if I can. It looks like I'll be able to go, but I won't know for another week or something.
But yeah, my impression is this is, Evan and everyone there expects this to be the biggest, most successful one yet. So, yeah. All right, I guess we'll move into auctions. So you go ahead, Carrington. Oh wait, we have to do the you were on the last show, Carrington. No fair. Oh wait, I guess I was too.
I'm gonna say, okay, I could go, but I think we're supposed to talk about the old ones.
Okay, so and I guess we'll keep this up, even though it's going to be a month between shows. I guess we all want to hear what happened. So Carrington, you had chose the. Are you going? You can speak to it, and then I'll go to the other
one. It was Jupiter Ace. Great. I think I talked about it at length in the last episode.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
the last one was on.
How did you?
Very, very, very rare item. I think it's sold too.
Oh, I'm there.
It shows it sold
for
about
$600.
Yeah, $623. So pound, yeah, 377 pounds.
I figured it would
pounds.
Go for quite a bit. It's very much a niche collectible. I don't know any people really into the offshoots of the Sinclair era and stuff. Yeah. But if you are, then this is one of the holy grails. And it's hard to find one of these in particular. So somebody got themselves a really neat item.
Yeah.
I could swear when I did my fourth episode on Retrobits that I talked about this machine, because it was one of the, tiny handful that didn't run BASIC as its native operating system.
Oh, really? Do you remember what it ran?
I think it ran fourth, didn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, it did.
I think so, right, because Carrington had spoken to that.
Oh, yes.
Well, then James from the RetroMac cast, who was on the last show, was he chose an Apple Lisa 1 Theory of Operations hardware manual from 1982. So this, of course, will be in the show notes. And it's still available at the $999.99. Buy it now. So rush right out. I think we predicted it may not sell for that. So that's kind of a little unreasonable, huh?
Gigantic amount of money. If I was going to try and sell something like that, I might at least do the eBay thing of or best offer, so that I wouldn't price myself out indefinitely. Because I don't know if somebody's going to come along and swoop this up for $1,000.
Right, because you can always not accept it or do just a good old auction with a reserve.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So the last item, so one I chose, was a Scion Series 3C. 2 megabit backlit screen. This one was also in the UK, and it sold for £60 sterling, for $99.05 American cashola. So, all right. So let's move on to this round. And so, Carrington, you go ahead and talk about your stuff.
I picked two. One a more serious pick than the other. The first is a 2GS accelerator. It's an 11 megahertz Transwarp GS. not a particularly crazily rare item. If you're looking for a Transwarp, these do come up every couple of months, maybe on eBay. What's nice about this one is it comes with a warranty. So it's from a seller that actually warrants these things. It's very rare. Huh. You can buy a vintage item and get a warranty on it.
I've heard of this guy before.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so it seems to be a very reputable seller. Will ship to Canada, so hooray for that. And it's $600, but it's the 11 megahertz version, so it's faster than your typical Transwarp.
It goes to 11. Look here, it turns up to 11.
Yes, exactly. So if you're a frequent user of a 2GS, there's very little you could do for your system that would make it more usable than to pop one of these things in. I mean, this really is the thing that makes it zip. So a little.
Was that standard 11 megahertz?
No. I think they normally came 6 to 8. Was it something like that? So,
okay.
But you can swap in a different oscillator and swap in a different 65, 8, 16 or whatever. Mm-hmm. So this is the 11 megahertz one. It comes totally complete and it's coming with a warranty. So I thought, it's expensive at $600, but
they have a buy it now.
It has to buy it now.
I'm sorry, I'd say
50% chance we will come back to the next show and it will be sold to me. So we'll see.
What I meant to say is
on the edge.
It has a make offer. So this person, I think, is kind of smarter.
Yeah. And then the other one I chose is there is a pre-Infocom version of Zork. So the earliest version of Zork. So you Infocom fans, it's a still boxed version. Box has been open and it's quite crushed. But it's a very rare item to find the old personal computing version. So mm-hmm. This is from before Infocom, and it's that version of Zork. But they want, what is it, $2,500 or something?
Yeah, $24.95, buy it now, or $19.95.
There is no chance we will come back to the next episode, and I will have bought this.
It's got free shipping.
I thought it was neat to talk about.
I just want to mention that. It's free shipping.
Oh, well, then I've changed my mind.
And just for everybody, I'm sure most people know this, but this – as far as this is going to end in 3 days and 10 hours as of now, but more than likely it's not going to sell and they're going to relist it. So even if you go here, look for the seller relisted or whatever, and there'll be a link on the page. So I predict it'll be relisted and maybe they'll drop the price even.
Yeah. And it has a normal auction as well. It's just the $2,500 is the buy it now price, but very, very expensive, but a particularly rare item. If I was buying something for that much money, though, I think I would hold off to get one with a good condition box, because it's not that this game isn't easily available on the net in a thousand different versions. And in fact, less buggy versions than this one. So this is really all about having the original item. And if that's the case, what you're paying for really is the disc and the instruction manual and the box. Hmm. And really, it's all about the box. So I'd be holding off for a less crushed, less destroyed version if I was really going to drop $2,500 on this.
Yeah, what do you think it's worth?
Not $2,500. Well, to me, for me, it's worth nothing. I don't really get games to collect them. I get them to play them. So
is that the holy grail of I know it's pre-Infocom, but is that the holy grail of Infocom sent games versus
saucer? It's all about this, the flying saucer and the suspended mask. Did I mention the suspended mask?
Yeah.
Oh, the suspended mask. And the flying saucer, which I don't have. Those to me are the – because that's from the days of the Feely era, and that's what really
– But I'm saying, is this arguably worth more, though?
No. Well, it is, just because it's more rare.
Yeah.
Much more rare, really early. Nobody at the time that this – box version was out would have anticipated that this would go on to be Infocom and Zork would go on to be the thing that it is. Mm-hmm. So that's what makes this much more rare and therefore I guess more collectible. But I'm not really much of a collector, so I'm less interested. The Transwarp GS, though, I'm kind of close to pulling the trigger on that one myself, so we'll see.
Okay.
Yeah. So those are my picks.
Very nice. And so Earl, you're next. You go ahead.
Yeah, so my pick for the eBay auction this time might be a little bit more, on the pedestrian side, a little bit more boring, but it caught my eye because, and I'll say what it is, it's a book on PET interfacing. But one of the reasons that it caught my eye is that I've been having fun lately playing with my Commodore PET 2001, and one of the things that has been interesting or has been interesting me is the idea of connecting up to it somehow with various devices. And this particular book is one of, there actually is more than one book talking about how to interface things to a Commodore PET. And one of the reasons that it was, I thought noteworthy is that there was a port on the Commodore computers called the user port on the Commodore 8-bits. It started with the PET, but that port actually perpetuated through the VIC-20, the Commodore 64, the 128, and it's a 5-volt parallel 8-bit bidirectional input-output port that's actually made for people to experiment with and to hook things with. And so, in a sense, kind of unique among the 8-bit computers in that this was made to horse around with from an electronics point of view. You know what I mean? I mean, you could interface over a serial port or whatever to all the 8-bits, but this port was there specifically for a hobbyist or a third-party product add-on or something like that to come along and interface with the machine.
Right,
so,
right. It was a closed machine otherwise, so it was just an
right,
external...
Didn't have expansion ports. Yeah, I mean, aside from the expansion slots, I should say, in the same sense as like an Apple II or something like that. So all these Commodores had this port, and these books will, you know, presumably tell you how to interface with that port and probably with the IEEE 488 port and that sort of thing. I also thought it was interesting, this particular seller, Benji 1999, had a number of other books and items from the PET being auctioned on eBay, and it kind of makes me wonder if it's somebody who's clearing out their PET collection. And as you pointed out, David, you put a link to the use.atoll.com site where you can see what the value of this particular book is, or at least what some people are selling it for. And it seems like the selling price here, $16.95, is a pretty good price.
Yeah,
I'm looking at, you know, if I look at this at all, the cheapest I could get it is $31 approximately.
Mm-hmm. That's so in the UK, so you'd have to pay,
pay
extra
some shipping
cash there.
So if you got it, you know, if you were to win.
Or you could ask them just to fax it to you.
Well, you know, it's interesting is that in a lot of cases, you can find these books in PDF form online. You know, whether that's by official permission of the author or not. You know? But in some of these cases, though, I still like to have the actual book because, it's just like you were saying with the game stuff, Carrington, I mean, it's kind of fun to actually have the materials that you had back in the day, as well as just the knowledge. I mean, if I was just looking for, okay, what's the pinout? I'd go find that online. But if I'm actually looking for a artifact that I could have as part of the collection here, that's what I would have used back in the day for a reference, then that's one of the reasons books, the retro books are fun to me. So,
absolutely. And what's nice about this book is it harkens back to one of the big differences between the earlier retro era of PCs, say, and now, is there were so many more options to have robots and other things attached to your computer in a real easy hobbyist way. I find that now to get a robot kit to connect to like a regular Mac, it's so much more involved and usually is such a bigger deal. And there were so many little do-it-yourself kits and build a robot arm kits and multiple Lego kits. There's even one on eBay at the moment, one of the early Dacta kits or whatever. So there's just so many more options, it seems, at the time. And maybe there was just more interest or something in having robotic bits and things attached. So that's what I like about this book.
Well, and the user port on the Commodores wound up making it a popular computer for electronic hobbyists. Ham radio operators loved them, too, for the ability to connect up to them and tinker like that. So, yeah, I never thought about the robotics angle, though. That's true.
They were, I was going to say, caring, there, you know, back then there was less home entertainment alternatives, too, perhaps.
Right.
I'm looking... when I went to the one and only vintage computer festival in California, I went to in 2006, there was a guy that had two Commodore PETs networked together with a special cable, I think, and they were playing a game. And I was just looking at their site, seeing if I could figure out what who that guy was and his webpage. Expanded? No. But anyway, it was very cool. You could, two people could sit at each one and, play a network game with each other.
There's a good Apple II networking item that came out a couple of years ago as well for direct computer-to-computer networking. In fact, I picked up one of the kits when I was at the one Kansas Fest I went to, but I haven't done anything with it yet. And along those lines, Ken Gagne, who does a lot of Apple II stuff and is, you know, sort of a big name in the Apple II circles, also writes stuff for Computer World. And he has in his Computer World cubicle a 2GS. And he recently blogged about getting it on the internet. He got an Ethernet card and now has it hooked up to the internet. So you can get on the net with his 2GS at Computer World. So very, very interesting stuff.
With my new job, I'm in IT. So with my new job, I actually have an office that can be locked because, you know, we keep computers and other stuff in there. So I haven't had an office in a while. So, I might do that. I think I might take a vintage computer and set it up there.
You wouldn't need to lock the door if you had a robotic arm and eye attached to it. And maybe the arm could be like armed.
And lasers.
You literally armed your computer.
All right. So my item is a Commodore 128 since I acquired one today, a fully working system. So basically I chose one that looked it's pretty complete other than a Commodore monitor, which you could fairly easily get or get an alternative or, of course, hook it up to your television. But let's see what this one's in. Doesn't say where it is. Anyway, Commodore 128, working system, disk drive, disk slot. It's got 4 days, $9.99 starting bid. $50 expedited shipping. Now that's to me in Georgia. So that's a little heavy, but shipping's gone up a lot recently.
With fuel prices and stuff, yeah.
So, So it's kind of a decent example of just a sort of average Commodore 128 system, and certainly a really good, if you could buy this for $20, let's say, and then you still got it for $50 shipping, that's not too bad. I guess, I don't know, you could probably acquire one cheaper if you're a little more patient and just looked at your local Craigslist and went to thrift stores and that kind of stuff. That's getting harder to do.
You sort of have to go local if you want to get a system with a monitor, because monitors are very expensive to ship. Monitors are increasingly becoming the bane of the vintage computer user because they're starting to die. There's few options to use modern monitors with older computers. I'm seeing it as really as one of the big weak points in using vintage systems is the lack of ability to use a modern monitor with them.
Yep. And the modern monitor technology is changing so fast that it's just getting more and more sophisticated. Mm-hmm. And so building that bridge between it doesn't help a lot that a lot of the 8-bit home computers had different technologies to connect up to the monitor. And then, of course, if you want something with worldwide appeal, you're going to have to support a couple of different video standards, NTSC and PAL. So,
and the old NTSC stuff that was here in North America, I mean, the old computers always just assumed it would be an old vintage television. So they did lots of little tweaks and stuff because most of it was running like the older, just under 15 hertz version or whatever of RGB. And that stuff just isn't supported by modern TVs at all, even though the cable is the same. You plug it in, you'll get garbage. And no modern monitor supported. It's becoming a real hassle.
And this is one thing. I have an Amiga monitor, and now I have this other 1902 Commodore monitor. So guys, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm trying to picture... I think they're very versatile with other old computer systems. I think I generally will pull out a Commodore monitor to use for a number of other systems. So
generally, if you have an old 8-bit era monitor and it's using an RGB connector, it'll probably connect the same way. But if you want to use the more native connector built into a system, like say you have a 2GS and you don't want to use the RGB connector, you want to use the monitor port, only option really is to use a 2GS monitor.
Yep.
And I have looked at a lot of the RGB converters. I want to do a review for 1 megahertz comparing them all. And so I brought in 8 or 9 different ones, and not a single one of them actually worked. They're all terrible. So really won't be much of a review other than for me to say, don't buy any of these. There's a few DIY kits, but they're a little vague on their specs and stuff. So I think I'm just going to have to build something. But it's becoming, I think I anticipate it being a real hassle, you know, 3 or 4 years from now, as more and more monitors just start to die. The old phosphor monitors just aren't going to live forever.
I guess the fortunate thing is that the circuitry in those monitors is actually fairly straightforward. So if you have access to someone who knows how to do things like TV repair and that, you might actually be, if it's not the tube itself, you might be able to bring it back to life if it burns out.
Right. So I think it is the tubes that are dying because they all get burned in and stuff. And
So but you know what? You can still find used TVs pretty cheap and pretty readily right now. Still, as always, a last ditch.
But they take up so much space. I live in a little tiny condo. It's one thing to have like four little vintage computers because they're so small, but to have these four extra monitors as well is it's real hassle. I want to have one monitor, ideally an LCD, that can simply interface to any vintage computer.
Yeah, I just wrote that down. I just wrote that down in some notes for us to maybe discuss for a future show. But yeah, that I think that's a good topic for us to come up with is display alternatives, specifically LCDs. I think they've been talking about this, in fact, at March's forum, you know, email discussion list or whatever. But yeah, that's a great, because, you know, adapters and LCDs that we can use on old, you know, vintage systems. Because I know it's being done. Like at VCF, you'll see that. Right. Let me mention just two more things then. So there's also a link that is simply a search on eBay for Commodore 128 under the, I guess it's Vintage Computers, Commodore, or whatever. And this just quickly gives you other alternatives of other, you know, Commodore 128 systems. But at the top, there's actually a B128, which is pretty rare. And it's a buy it now at $750, kind of a lot, but pretty rare system. But I want to mention, too, like the system that I acquired today, the gentleman gave to me, is the reason he did this, for anybody out there, is I run a little ad on Craigslist. So if you go to a Craigslist and go to Atlanta and do a search for Commodore or Atari or something, you'll find my ad. And I renew it about every 3 days. And so basically I'm saying, don't throw away that old computer. If you've got an Atari or an Apple II or a Commodore or something pre-Windows typically, you know, give it to me. Yeah, I'm not looking to buy anything, but give it to me before you throw it away, or give it to a thrift store or someplace where they'll tear it apart or salvage it or whatever.
That's a really good idea to be proactive about that kind of stuff, because most people with really old vintage computers are just going to chuck it in the trash, frankly. They won't even think to walk it down to like a Goodwill store. So
And then I'm in my area here. I've lived here a year and a half, so I'm getting to know things. I would know either how to find it new homes if necessary or where to give it where they're not going to rip it apart, because there's some thrift stores that they'll they won't, like Goodwill, and I could be wrong, not all of them, but I think Some they don't even take them now, but they'll just ship them off to like a main center where they're just ripped apart or salvaged or whatever. Anyway, but I acquired this system, and this is also how I acquired the Altair and a desk. If you're interested in that, go to my blog, and I have a good article about it. So a gentleman in Nashville, Tennessee, you know, essentially gave me that system to preserve, and I'm trying to find a museum for it. All right. Well, I think that wraps up our auctions, and I'll mention the time here. So we're doing pretty good, guys. Looks like we're went a little long, but we're getting our timing and everything all together, right?
Nice. Yeah, getting the flow.
But for a monthly show, I mean, I think everybody probably doesn't mind having lots of content. So really the last thing for us to do is just kind of close out. So I'll mention that our next show session is set for May 21st. That's 4 weeks from now. That's our schedule. And so Earl will be hosting that show. And so how about, I'll turn to you, Carrington. What tell us what you're up to.
Well, in the vintage computer stuff, I finally finished the long overdue latest episode of 1 Megahertz, which has now just finished uploading in the background while we record this. That might not have been the wisest thing to do, but I'm a risky fellow. And I also have Double Take, which comes out every Wednesday, which is sort of a movie review podcast that I do with a friend of mine each week, which is fun. So yeah, keeping up with that stuff. No new acquisitions in Apple II stuff, but I have a shelf full of things I've been meaning to get to. So I got to decide what I'll be reviewing for the next show, which I'll look at this afternoon.
Cool. Yeah, I just launched iTunes, so it's downloading the new Retro Maccast. Those guys are timely. So I guess you got to do your RSS for the 1 megahertz.
Sure. Yeah, that one I do by hand. Okay. Actually, the Double Take one's automatic, and for some reason, 1 megahertz I do completely hand rolled.
And I don't know who anybody. Most people don't like movies. I think we all kind of like movies. We all have our own personal tastes, you know. So I'm not a huge movie person, though. But anyway, I've started listening to Double Take, and it's great, and it's relatively short, so which is kind of a
yeah,
you know. which is good.
Yeah, we our goal is to make them 20 minutes. We've gone a little bit longer on the last couple of shows, but we talked about it and we're trying to get it under 20 minutes for future episodes. It should be, you know, get in, talk about them, get out.
Mm-hmm. And so you guys are, I like it. So, and it's, so, you know, by knowing you and finding out about that, I'm now listening to a podcast that I wouldn't have necessarily known about or, you know, tried. So,
and what's fun about it is neither of us know what movies, because we assign each other the film. Mm-hmm. So we open up the envelope live, and so I never know what I'm going to be watching next week either. So it's fun for me too.
Maybe we could do something like that.
Open up the envelope. What game will you be playing?
Yeah.
And what about you, Earl? What's new with you?
Oh, what's going on? Well, from the retro perspective, as I was mentioning earlier, man, it's like all the oxygen got sucked out of the room. In my life, I haven't had a lot of time for the retro computing hobby, but did get a RetroBits episode out, as we mentioned earlier in the show, regarding the Vintage Computer Festival East. Was excited about that. It was a fun time talking with Evan Koblenz. And also, my target, and I kind of alluded to this in the last RetroBits, is to release a RetroBits podcast on a staggered format from the Retro Computing Roundtable. So, kind of every month there'll be a retro. It's every month there'll be a retro computing round, but they'd be staggered by 2 weeks. So kind of a show, you know, trying to get myself in front of the mic every couple of weeks to get some material out. And just on the you know, home personal hobby front here, my daughter and I think I might have mentioned this too last time. We've been working through learning how to program in BASIC. She wants to do computer programming. And I think it's great. She's 12. Her mind's sucking it up like a sponge. And so we're kind of doing a combination of learning how to program the computer and learning computer history at the same time. We started all the way back on the Commodore PET, worked our way up to the Atari 800. Ooh, you know, jump in technology. Now we got color and sound. And from there we'll go, you know, late 80s, mid 90s, and eventually work ourselves up to programming on modern platforms. So,
that's great.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun so far, and you know, I'm anticipating good things coming out of that. I'm, you know, hoping her interest stays piqued on this, and so I'll let you guys know how it goes. But that's what's up with me.
She's your youngest?
Yeah, I have two kids. Joshua's 13, Jessica's 12.
Okay.
And so yeah, which, you know, obviously keeps life pretty busy too.
Yeah. Well, I need to, I haven't, you know, I haven't specifically trying to set up anything or break anything out for my little boy. I have an 8-year-old, it's my youngest. I guess I'll mention. So I have an almost 18-year-old daughter and a 16-year-old son. So I got two high schoolers and then an 8-year-old second grader. But yeah, a few years ago, I broke out a bunch of Macs and stuff and, you know, like SEs and pluses, and he enjoyed playing with games there. And, you know, and he's played Commodore 64s, but I just haven't done it recently. So you've kind of inspired me to try that. You know, do that some more. So, well, great. So I guess to close out, so, you know, what I'm doing is, so good, we got this show on the tracks, and I'm really happy about that. So I think this is a great vehicle for all three of us, you know, and for our fans, and, you know. So we got this done. I'm kind of following what you're saying, Earl. So, you know, I still have a Stan Veets History of the Personal Computer podcast chapter to get done. I want to get back doing a video podcast, which will be much shorter, like 10 or 15 minutes at most. And essentially try to do each one of those about once a month. Just to mention, too, I've been in the process of trying to get a sort of a march, you know, like what Evan Koblenz has going here in the Atlanta area. And it's kind of starting to pick up. So we have a meeting, which is going to happen Saturday, May 7th. And then the first Saturday in June, there's a big ham fest here in the Atlanta area in Marietta, which is west. And so we're going to have a table and display machines and have a presence there. So that's exciting.
That's the Historical Computer Society?
Yes, which that name, you know, is something I came up with years ago. And we're sticking with it for now. Frankly, I think we should change it. It's a little stuffy sounding.
So, the Historical Computer Society.
Right. So at some point, I think we'll change it. And kudos to Evan for suggesting this too, where it's more regional, you know, something Atlanta or Southeast or something, you know, computer collectors or computer enthusiasts or something like that. Retro computer enthusiasts. So, but for now it's a name and it works. So basically a user group for guys like us, you know, we're in person, we can break out old machines and play with them and stuff. But, you know, Earl, you know, being in user groups, there's a lot to finding a place that you can go to every month, you know, that hopefully has good parking close by to carry stuff in, and, you know, and tables to work on, electricity, internet, wireless, you know, projectors to do presentations, all that kind of stuff.
Yep, reliable facilities. Yes, but that have all that stuff you said, and that you can kind of plan and schedule in advance. Yeah, that is a challenge.
Right, and so the goal is to become a nonprofit or a true user group. I guess nonprofit organization that's self-governing and so like, for instance, I guess I'm the president, if you will. But you know, I don't care. I just want to be involved. So down the road, we'll start having elections and let somebody else run it. Be fine with me.
Well, sure, because maybe if you can go beyond just being self-governing and become actually self-aware, then it can just run itself. It's Sky. I mean, we're supposed
like
to have
Skynet
go live recently. So
that was supposed to be recent. Yeah.
Yeah. It is Portal launched, or Portal 2, rather. So I'm disappointed it didn't happen. Oh, well.
I knew you were going to that Skynet reference. Guys, good to talk to you.
Absolutely.
Earl takes the reins next
awesome.
Time.
What's that, David?
I said you take the reins next time.
Will do.
So see you guys then.
All right. Have a good one.
Thanks again, everyone, for listening and for your support. Look for the discuss links in the show notes. I forgot to do this part live. We'd love to hear from you, so email me at david@classiccomputing.com. I'll forward it along to both Carrington and Earl. We really want to hear your comments about the show, and especially this new format. How about that posting time, huh? Same day. Talk to you next time.